Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest, over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
But dude averages 18 yards after catch.
We get it. When you're passionate about something, you go all in. You live entirely in that world. That's exactly how Graybar is about renewable energy projects.
He's all fourth quarter, such a
sleeper. Join our league of clean energy at Graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
So there has been an agreement between Israel and Hamas on a ceasefire, a release of hostages, and already, in the immediate aftermath of that agreement, there is some troubling revelations about whether or not Hamas is trying to change the terms and conditions of that agreement. Officials involved have said this is a complex arrangement. And Hamas has a history of backing out of these deals. 468 days the hostages have been in custody. Hamas broke ceasefire deals with Israel in 03, 07, 08, and nine times in 2014. And they walked away from any number of offers recently since the October 7th horrific event in the months of December, January, February, March, April, May, June, and July of 2024. So they really have a bad track record, and it's going to be interesting to see whether or not we can reach phase one in order to get to phase two. And here to talk with us about it is Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. Colonel, thank you for joining us this morning. We truly appreciate it.
Always a great pleasure.
So, Colonel, officials that have were part of this process say that this is a very complex arrangement. You heard what I said about the history of Hamas and walking away from this. What is your appreciation of what is accomplished by this ceasefire agreement?
Well, first of all, I think what you outlined was exactly correct in terms of how Hamas has conducted itself. As far as bringing this agreement to a close, it's also important to realize that there's strong opposition in Israel, one of the delays of the moment at least, as well as some suggestions that Hamas is trying to change the deal, but the Israeli cabinet has not ratified this particular agreement. And that has now been postponed, and I don't know if it'll happen today or happen tomorrow. The problem being that several of the very conservative members of Mr. Netanyahu's cabinet have refused to endorse the treaty, have refused because they believe they should recommence hostilities after the initial tranche of about 33 hostages are in fact released. And if they don't endorse it, then they could actually take a vote of no confidence in the Knesset and bring down his government. So there's some problems on the Israeli side as well. But I think the operative phrase in this, or the operative adjective, is temporary. This is a temporary ceasefire, as you say, though, a very complex arrangement that will allow about 30-plus hostages to be released, about 1,000 Palestinians. And then after 16 days, start negotiating phase two, which will be the rest of the hostages for additional Palestinian release, Israeli military moving out of the Gaza Strip but maintaining buffers on the northern end and along the Philadelphia corridor near the Egyptian border. And then if we get through that, then you get to phase four, which perhaps is the most important in many ways, because that's the one that we'll talk about establishing some kind of political authority and reconstruction that, if infected, would bring stability to the region.
Obviously, there's interest by Hamas in order to hold their organization together, right? I mean, that doesn't go away.
In a way, though you can understand it from the Israeli perspective, I mean, the despicable things that Hamas did on October 7th, 2023, but at the same time, in terms of just a flat negotiations, the Israelis have said that their goal is a total destruction of Hamas. I was always personally a little skeptical whether you can destroy an ideology. You can destroy its military capabilities. You can kill its political leaders. Not sure you can destroy an ideology. But destroy Hamas and get the hostages released. Well, in a way, those are contradictory objectives, because the only leverage Hamas has as they lose more and more military capabilities are the hostages. And once they're released, then the possibility of the Israelis moving on even with greater fervor in their second objective of destroying Hamas has no impediment. So there's always been a bit of a contradiction there that we've been trying to straddle as these negotiations have gone on. And frankly, what's interesting, of course, is this particular agreement is basically the agreement proposed by President Biden back in May. I mean, we've been basically talking about this for now for about 8 months.
Yeah, not much has changed in that regard. What's interesting to me is that, and the reason I said that Hamas is going to do the things that they need to do to try and keep Hamas together as an organization. Right. Symbolically, when you look at the list of individuals that they want to release, and I think this is one of the first bumps in the road, Israel wanted to retain the right to be able to veto whatever right. the request was as to who was going to be released. And obviously, Hamas puts at the top of the list the mass murderers that killed more Israelis and others than any others, obviously looking for that symbolic oomph, so to speak, as it relates to their ability to negotiate hard deals with Israel. This is what's happened every time. Israel gives up 100 prisoners and Hamas gives up a dozen. Yeah. I mean,
actually, even less than that. I mean, if you look back to the release of an Israeli soldier a few years ago, I think they released about 1,000 for one Israeli hostage. So you're exactly right in terms of raw numbers. That has been totally disproportionate. It appears that we're talking about 1,000 Palestinians in the first release. It's important to understand, though, that many, if not the majority of those Palestinians, were probably detained on the West Bank and not detained in Gaza and transported, because the Israelis have a longstanding detention policy and over the course of this conflict have detained thousands of people. And in many cases, to be perfectly frank, detained people without any opportunity for them to have any kind of, you know, judicial review. If you're arrested on the West Bank and you're an Israeli, you appear in front of a regular civilian court. If you're a Palestinian and you're arrested on the West Bank for the same transgression, you appear in front of a military tribunal. And that's just the way law has been established. So the first 1,000, you're exactly right. They're talking 150 to 250 of the Palestinians released have life sentences for various things that they've done, probably involving the killing of Israelis. But about 560 are going to be women and elderly people who have been held for some time by the Israeli authorities.
The search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.
Hey, football fans, it's Patrick Peterson, former three-time All-Pro NFL cornerback, and now the new host of First and Pod, the podcast that breaks down every game, every week, with new episodes dropping every Monday and Friday mornings. Plus, I'll be highlighting key matchups for DBs around the league on Patrick's Corner. Be sure to subscribe to First and Pod on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So if Israel decides to exercise that veto or what, however they refer to it, or the right to, you know, not approve of it, I think it's kind of hard for Hamas to swallow that, right?
It probably will be, because, of course, they've got their own constituencies they've got to deal with. And you're exactly right as well. What you said already, Norman, is for Hamas, what is their objective? If Israel's objective, and they said this over and over, is to destroy Hamas and get the hostages released. Hamas's objective in these negotiations is to survive in some form, to survive. And that, as a consequence, that means they've got to establish or try to maintain some level of legitimacy in the eyes of those who support it. So that's why I think they would continue to be very insistent on the particular people that they're arguing for to be released. Now, that being said, it does appear that those who are released, even if they were detained on the West Bank, will be released in Gaza and not released back on the West Bank, where they would have connections and whatever, and perhaps could, you know, pick up where they left off.
Colonel, are you surprised, and maybe they've done it and they've just not released it? I mean, I've been completely mystified by the fact that we've had no proof of life process that has gone on. We've right. talked about these numbers generally. They're saying that there's 33. Mike Waltz on Fox the other day says that they've confirmed that there's 25 alive and probably the remaining eight are dead. But it seems to be a moving target. And then in reporting this morning, they talk about having found two more people that they believe might be alive. I mean, it seems to be, I don't know, it's a weird process. I mean, usually you engage in some kind of proof of life procedure early onset, wouldn't you?
Well, exactly. I mean, this is where Hamas wants to have it both ways. They would like to be treated in many ways in negotiation as if they were a government, which they are not. They're a government that was elected for the Gaza Strip, but they're not internationally recognized. But if they're a government, then they would have to, in terms of the laws of armed combat, be subjective to those laws, which would be the identities to the Red Cross of those people who have been captured. By the way, you wouldn't take hostages to begin with. That's against international law, but at least you'd tell who they are. But in this case, I think what's going on is two things. One is that they are trying to extract every possible concession they can get in any way, shape, or form for anything that they would provide the Israelis. So that type of information, valuable to the Israelis, would only be provided at some price, at some concession. And second of all, what worries me the most is they may not know, because there's real reason to believe that a number of the hostages are not held by Hamas, but are held by other groups, Islamic Jihad, or even criminals that are in the Gaza Strip. So they may not have absolute knowledge of the names of all the hostages even, or certainly their particular status, dead or alive.
But if that is in fact the case, I've never negotiated one of these deals, but just as a lawyer thinking about bidding against myself, the agreement's not worth the paper it's written on. Because if Hamas doesn't really have control of the Islamic Jihadist or these criminal organizations within Gaza, what am I negotiating and with whom?
Well, that's exactly right, and that's what makes this particular negotiation so unbelievably complex on the one hand and, frankly, problematical on the other hand. The possibility of getting through phase one and getting 33 hostages, which, in fact, I'm pretty optimistic that Hamas has in hand, that may have a pretty good probability. Going beyond that, that's where things may actually get really difficult. And then getting to the third phase, where you start talking about what's going to be sort of the political governing authority of this region that's going to respond to the destruction that's occurred and the plight of 2 million-plus Palestinians, that really gets even more problematical.
So do you really go through this process in order to test the strength of Hamas and how much control they actually have over Gaza? Because it seems to me one of the byproducts of this situation at this juncture is they may not have that much control.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's certainly one of the byproducts of the particular negotiation. But all sides as well have their own particular responsibilities at home. And clearly there's, and for very good reason, has been an enormous groundswell amongst the Israeli population to do everything possible to get these hostages released. And of course, the demonstrations you can see on the news on a regular basis outside the Knesset just underscore that. So the Israeli government has a responsibility to do everything they can within reason to secure these people's release. But again, there's other objectives, and that's why I said, for example, at the top, there are very conservative people in Israel who are opposed to this agreement, and they had very high positions, a couple of members of Mr. Netanyahu's cabinet, who, A, don't trust Hamas, B, don't think we're going to get anything beyond 33, and C, therefore, insist that the Israelis recommence hostilities once the first tranche is completed and skip phase two and phase three and just go back to war. They have other objectives, though. They are very outspoken that they really want to formally take over the Gaza Strip. They want to formally evict the 2 million people that are there. Haven't really said where they're going to go, but get them out of there and fill the Gaza Strip back with settlers and make it into Israeli territory. They are also very outspoken about formally annexing the West Bank, which they call Judea and Samaria, not the West Bank, and expelling a large number of the population that are Palestinian there and expanding the number of settlements. One thing that's occurred during this war, which hasn't gotten, I think, a lot of coverage, is the Israelis have significantly expanded the number of settlements on the West Bank with Israelis and pushed out more and more Palestinians, even while these hostilities were going on.
Well, obviously, Hamas and Hezbollah and Fatah are their closest territorial enemies, right? But it isn't really the bigger existential threat, Iran. And if there's not some kind of Iranian component to this and working with the Arabs and others and Qatar or Qatar or however they say it, you know, it would seem to me that we kind of lose sight of who actually is being funded, financed, and you know, who the true allies of these folks are that are really the thorn in the side of the Israelis more so than anybody else.
Well, without question. I mean, the Israelis would tell you the ultimate problem is always Iran. Iran was the place that Hamas received funding for its military. It's where Hezbollah, in particular, received an enormous amount of funding. And at this particular moment, of course, Iran is probably in the most vulnerable position it's been in, frankly, for decades. Its two primary clients have their military capabilities largely destroyed. Hamas, clearly, but even more importantly, I think in some ways, Hezbollah, which was really the ultimate deterrent for Iran by the hundreds of thousands of rockets and missiles that Hezbollah had in its possession. And so always the way deterrence would work was if the Israelis struck Iran, the Iranians would unleash Hezbollah to fire thousands and thousands of rockets on Israel, and therefore a delicate deterrence balance existed. Well, for the Iranians, that deterrence is gone. And furthermore, these Israelis, in response to Iranian attacks, have done two missile attacks on Iran, destroyed a lot of their air defense capabilities, destroyed some factories that provide propellant for Iranian missile systems. So Iran is about as vulnerable to a big attack by Israel as they've ever been. And furthermore, the Iranian economy is really in very bad shape. There's reports of electricity blackouts. There's reports of the currency hitting one of its lowest levels and a lot of social unrest. So the Iranians really are facing, I think, as Mr. Trump arrives and being so vulnerable with two options, and the Israelis will be part and parcel of these discussions. A, they quickly move to some kind of negotiation with the Trump administration on their nuclear capabilities, or B, they accelerate their efforts to acquire nuclear weapons to reestablish some kind of deterrence. And that's a powder keg that Mr. Trump and his incoming administration, along with the Israelis, are going to deal with.
It would seem to me, I don't know, I'd love to know your reaction, that President-elect Donald Trump's comment about all hell will break loose in the Middle East was really not directed toward Hamas or Fatah or Hezbollah, but really right at between the eyes of Iran, knowing that they could exert their influence on these organizations to capitulate to some of the demands of the West.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. But I think the other component of that was it also was at the Israelis. And the biggest argument Mr. Netanyahu has with the conservative members of his administration is we don't want to anger the incoming Trump administration. We want to annex at least the West Bank, maybe not Gaza, but we want to formally annex the West Bank. And the Trump administration will support us in doing that. I mean, you look at the ambassador that's been appointed to go to Israel, Mike Huckabee, who is an evangelical Christian, as we all know, and very supportive of the idea of this is Judea and Samaria. It's truly part of Israel, has been part of Israel for centuries and centuries. It was the Trump administration in the last term who acknowledged and supported the Israelis formally annexing the Golan Heights. It was the Trump administration, of course, that moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So the Trump administration in the past has been very supportive of those aspirations by the Israelis, and I think they expect they will be so again. But the price of admission, I think, for Mr. Trump is you got to bring this agreement and bring this war to a close.
I'm not a betting man, but I don't know.
I wouldn't bet on anything in the Middle East whatsoever.
Colonel, you know, it's one of those things, the more you read, the kind of the more confused you get, right? And it's just right. So many. This is like a chess game with pieces that we've never seen before on a board. And
Well, you know, not to cut you off, but what really we need to, I think, understand is this particular war and its aftermath, the destruction of these proxies of Iran. And we're skipping over, and we haven't even talked about the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria.
In terms of the overall region,
this is equivalent to the end of the Berlin Wall. This is the end of the Cold War. I mean, this is all the pieces haven't been rearranged on the chessboard. They've been thrown up in the air over the chessboard. And so there's an opportunity for a significant realignment in the region that might bring stability. But also, in every opportunity, there's a danger. There's a danger for renewed, if not expanded, violence.
Well, Colonel, we got to get to a break, and we've run out of time. We really appreciate your time and your insight. We know you're busy, and I love the way that you're able to kind of put this in the most order and structure, not only for me after getting confused, but I think the listening audience as well, and we really appreciate your time.
Well, hopefully, I don't think we cheered anybody up, but hopefully we provide them a little bit more perspective.
You're absolutely correct. Thank you so much, and Happy New Year to you. That's Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. We'll be right back, 504-260-1870 on the Okunor Jewelers Talk and text line. When we return, we'll visit with the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Louisiana, Billy Nungesser. Stay with us.